colleges are very interesting, Jamie. They're competitors with each other, but they idea share for best practices. Very few other industries will do this. You'll have the human resources directors and the CFOs at colleges actually saying, hey, this is what worked for us, and this is what made us successful, or hey, don't do this. This really burned us last year. Like, what other industry would have competitors sharing that kind of information with each other? So once I got in with them as the guy that does college insurance, it really took off, man.
The key to life, it isn't money. It's happiness. And when you measure how happy you are, you actually become even more happy. Our friends at GoBundance, the tribe of millionaires, use a very specific tool to measure their happiness. It's called the Life Happiness Index. And you can have it too. Go over to GoBundance.com/LHI and take your Life Happiness Index assessment. You'll rate yourself in multiple categories on exactly how happy you are and get a custom output for you specifically that you can use in developing whatever goals you have for your life. GoBundance is the tribe of healthy, wealthy, generous people who choose to live epic lives. And the tool GoBundance members use at the base of all of that is the Life Happiness Index. Get out there and grab life big. What's going on, everybody? Welcome to the Tribe of Millionaires podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Gruber. My guest today, John Sarasani, started a business back in the early 2000s that he rolled up to private equity for a really, really, really healthy exit. Today, he's the host of the 2000% Raise podcast, and he is blowing up everywhere on social at the moment, from anything from financial advice to blackjack. It's crazy. We're going to get into it. But John, man, it's been a long time. Glad to have you here.
Here's my blackjack advice. Don't gamble at the casinos in Punta Cana. I'll tell you that much.
Have you lost here?
I will say this, man. Your audience is probably like, who the hell is this guy? What are they talking about? But I will say this, man. When I gambled once in the Dominican Republic, and I don't mind actually losing there. But like, if I lose, I want it to be at like Caesar's Palace or stuff. I felt like I was in like my buddy's basement gambling in a casino. You know what I mean? It's like. Yeah. It's like, you know, make me feel a little bit better about the $5,000 I just gave you. Please.
I love that.
And I'll never forget. I got so pissed off at the guy because we were playing blackjack and he kept playing everyone's hand for them, like just based on basic strategy. He just assumed he wanted to play basic strategy. I don't know if there's a law there, Jamie, or what, but like, do the casinos have to close at a certain time? Because it always felt like they were trying to get as many hands in as possible before they closed at 1 a.m. or whenever the hell they closed. You know what I mean?
Maybe
it was just the casino I was at. But I'm sitting here with the girl I was dating at the time. I'm trying to like show her how to play and stuff. And it's like, dude, will you let her give you the hand signal that she's staying on 14? I know you have a 3. Yes, she's going to stay. But will you like humor us? And let her do it, please.
That's hilarious. Not at all. I want to get into some of the stuff as we go. But let's do this. So you were a sales guy, Arthur Gallagher and Associates or whatever. Made $140,000 a year in your early mid-20s. You end up leaving, starting your own business from your kitchen table. You talk about it, man. Massive profit margins. And eventually you roll up to private equity. And then from what I understand, and we can get into it, like you almost like tripled the initial exit by just holding the stock long-term. I'll let you explain that. But here's my question. Did you start that business with the intention of one day exiting the way you did, or did that just present itself somehow at some point and was just like, oh, okay, I didn't think to do this, but sure, let's go.
Yeah, quite the opposite. I never had intended to sell it. It was a cash cow. I had huge profit margins. I had a really good thing going on. And for me, I didn't know when I was ever going to retire, because I'm like, why would I ever walk away from this? Maybe hand it off to my kids or something. I don't know, but I had a really good thing going. And the market, I initially looked into it. The mergers and acquisitions market was calling for a 1.5 to 2 times gross revenue multiple when I first got into the business. So you would sell it to a strategic, like my former employer, or Aon or Marsh or Willis. Those are the big dogs in the industry, or Hub. And they'd come buy you for 1.5 to 2 times your gross revenue. Well, I had like an 80% profit margin, literally. Industry average is like 20%. I had 80%. And it's because I had a niche focus. But company, because why would I sell? If I'm making an 80% profit margin, why would I sell to somebody for 2 times gross? I could just sit here and do nothing for 2.5 years and probably, you know, the clients wouldn't take them that long to fire me. You know what I mean? I would never do that, right? But it changed, Jamie. 9.5 years in, private equity entered the space. So they entered it before that, but they contacted me for the first time at that point. And I had no idea what they were willing to pay for agencies like mine, and they came and bought us. We had a niche focus with colleges and universities. We had that middle market. We had huge profit margins, and they came in and purchased us for close to 10 times EBITDA. So instead of being a 2x gross revenue, we were now at 10 times EBITDA, roughly. And for everybody else, this wasn't that big of a change that was the model now. But for me, it was, because my profit margins were so huge. Had I only been at a 20% profit margin, 10 times EBITDA is about the same as 2x gross if you have a 20% profit margin. Well, for a guy like me with an 80% profit margin, it was truly a game changer. And I just remember telling my lawyer, he was a buddy of mine from Northwestern. I'm like, buddy, just don't screw this up with legal crap. That they're overpaying me. They don't know what they're doing. They're morons.
That's awesome. What were you selling exactly to college and university? What was the product? It was an insurance product, but what was it?
So I developed a niche with employee benefits consulting and brokerage, and specific to colleges and universities. Most in that space do not focus on an industry. Instead, they focus on geography, and their value proposition will be like, hey, you know, Blue Cross has these hospitals in the network in your local area. Aetna and United Healthcare have these, you know, in their PPO. You also have this HMO option. And quite honestly, it's very basic shit that anyone could really learn after a week in the business if you just study that geographical region. So what I started doing was saying, okay, how could I create a value proposition that's different than what everyone else is saying? Because the big dogs and the little dogs were saying what I just said, but then on top of it, the big dogs will say, hey, we got 20,000 employees and 200 offices internationally. Well, who gives a fuck? What does that have to do with that client? 19,998 of those people ain't working on that account. So I'd get over that hump by explaining that to the client, and then the client looks at me and goes, okay, well, so what? What do you do different? Good point. Here's what I do different. I focus specifically on colleges and universities. We know, and colleges are very interesting, Jamie, because they idea share. They're competitors with each other, but they idea share for best practices. Very few other industries will do this. You'll have the human resources directors and the CFOs at colleges actually saying, hey, this is what worked for us, and this is what made us successful, or hey, don't do this. This really burned us last year. Like, what other industry would have competitors sharing that kind of information with each other? So once I got in with them as the guy that does college insurance, it really took off, man. It took a couple years to get going, but once it went, it went.
Damn, man. Now, when you exited, there was a 5-year employment contract that you had to stay on. Well, did you have an option to take the cash and go, or stock and stay? And did you have an option first off? And then would you do it any differently than you did? Would you take cash if you could, or was the stock the right play?
No, I don't think I wouldn't have had the option to do that. I guess I could have breached the contract and I would have been just walking away from a lot of money on the table if I wouldn't have fulfilled the employment contract. And I suppose they probably could have sued me for the money they already gave me if I really thought about it. But the way it was structured, it was you wouldn't want to walk away from it. And insurance is one of those businesses that's so relationship driven that they really need that 5-year employment contract to institutionalize the business. They want to make me irrelevant. If I leave 6 months later or even the next day, all those clients are leaving too. They don't know who this company is that just bought us. You know what I mean? So that's just kind of the way it is in that business. So I was fine with that. The only thing I would really do over is the stock performed so well, the stock portion that I took of the company that bought mine, I had an option to even take more. I took 35% of my deal in stock. I had to take at least 10%, but I could have taken up to 50%. If I had to do it over again, I would have taken the 50% because it did very well, my friend.
Yeah, I think I read like a few months after it was acquired, it rolled maybe to another private equity firm and like doubled or tripled the stock at that point, and you let it ride essentially. And so your exit became a multiple of the exit. A great exit became even more of a multiple of the exit. Is that right?
Yeah, I really exited the company. I really kind of sold the company 3 times, if you look at it that way. And that's how my accountant, my accountant has to look at it that way, because the way the capital gains and everything worked, it does look like I had 3 exits from an accounting standpoint. Because what happened was 2 months after I sold my company, the private equity firm sold to a different private equity firm and I had stock. So that stock tripled at that point. Okay. I couldn't believe it. It was nuts. Holy crap. Well, everyone else is taking all their money off the table. They'd been waiting 7 years for this to happen. Well, it just happened for me in 2 months. Everyone's going nuts. And I'm like, what just happened? So anyway, I still had to work there for 5 years. So I decided to leave all my money in there. I didn't liquidate any of my stock. You know, the lawyers and the accountants were telling me I'm crazy. Left it all in. And then right at the end of my employment contract, that private equity firm then sold it to another private equity firm and the stock tripled again. So essentially, if you look at it from a percentage standpoint, the 35% turned into 105% of the whole deal. And then that 105% turned into 315%. And timing was impeccable. And Jamie, I like to think that I've lived my life a certain way. There's a lot of opportunities in a lot of businesses, but there's definitely a lot of opportunities in insurance to screw people over, to kind of do things a little bit below board, a little bit on the shady side. And I never did that. I always treated my clients fairly. I never overcharged them. I, you know, followed through with meetings when I said I was going to and did what I said I was going to do. And I really kind of think that even though I'm not necessarily a spiritual person, I think the universe karma kind of played a role in that, because the timing couldn't have went better for me, my man.
I thought you weren't a universe karma guy. This is new. Is this a new leaf you're turning over?
Exactly. Although someone's trying to get me to do the frickin' thing down in, this is probably nothing related to that, but
what's the ayahuasca?
Yeah, exactly. Ayahuasca or whatever it's called in Peru or wherever, Bolivia or wherever the hell. I'm like, it'll change you. I like who I am. I like who I am right now. Why do you want to change me? I'm very happy with myself.
I did psilocybin in Michigan. I did like a five grams of mushrooms for a guy my size. I'm 5'7". You're like 6'11", I know, but that it fucked me up, man. I went deep over the course of 5 or 6 hours. Ayahuasca's taking that like 10X. Yeah. It's going to the next level, you know?
Bro, I did chocolate-covered mushrooms at a bachelor party once, and I don't know. I've never laughed harder in my life. My face hurt, and I've never done them again. I never did them again. You know what, though? It's funny, though. It's not like I wouldn't do them again. No one's really ever had them around me. Although recently, all these people in L.A., I've been hanging out in L.A. a lot. People are all microdosing mushrooms out there, and I guess I don't want to anymore, but where were you 15 years ago? I would have done that.
Yeah, I know, right? I get it. So, all right, so you exit. This is 2019, I think, when you're finally done with the employment contract. What do you do then? Did you, I mean, take some time? Like, what was life like after you're completely gone, exited, and you have your money in the bank?
Yeah, so I was supposed to be done with the employment contract in April of 2020, and things started going south of the last 12 months of my employment contract, just in terms of my relationship with the company that bought mine. And it was really more of a function of, I guess it was really a function of just like, we kind of grew and grew and grew, and I was always that one guy that was kind of stretching himself out, trying to help other offices out and everything else. And it started to become too much because I had other offices like using my college client list to go get prospective meetings with colleges when they have no business selling to these colleges. They're just not going to do well at it. And then I'm being asked to like fly out to Cleveland, help them sell this college. And then I'm like, am I going to service it for them too? And you know, that happens one too many times. And I just start to put my hands up. I go, no, I ain't doing this. I don't get compensated for it, number one. Well, aren't you supposed to be a team player? You're a future executive. No one else is doing this shit. You know who's doing this shit? All the people that suck. The W-2 employees that were at agencies that sold to you guys, and that owner disappeared into the sunset. And this guy that was never high, you know, he never got rich. He was a W-2 employee that's in management. And yeah, he's stretching himself, being on committees and stuff. And, you know, I just, you know, anyway. So things went south. And we ended up parting ways before the employment contract was up. And it ended up being a huge blessing in disguise for me, Jamie, because that was in December of 2019. And what was supposed to happen was just, it was, they kind of screwed something up the way we parted ways. They're like, if anybody parted ways, it was supposed to be for cause, and there was no cause. And it turned into kind of a legal thing where I ended up making out on that deal. And what that ended up doing was stretching out the time that I had shares in the company. So I was still getting paid by the company and still receiving value from the growth of the stock in the company all the way till the fall of 2022. No, fall of 2022.
Oh, no shit.
Yeah. It just unfolded that way because they did something they weren't supposed to do. I was able to negotiate something legally. And then also just the stock, when it switched to the new company, to the new private equity firm, they didn't buy out employees the day they left. They bought it out at 40% now, 30% 12 months from now, and then 30% 12 months from now. And I also had a severance worked in where before that even kicked in. So it ended up stretching me all the way to the fall of 2022. So those first few years, or first couple of years I'm done, I'm sitting here like, well, it's kind of nice. My net worth is still going up. I'm not working, you know. So I did get into stuff, though. I knew I had to prepare for the day that I wasn't going to be making any more money from them, albeit I knew it was going to be enough money where I didn't really need to work. So I started dabbling in venture capital and learned a lot over those 2 years. Talk about things you'd do differently. I did a lot of things I would have done differently. But I will tell you, as a venture capitalist and as an angel investor, some of the mistakes I did make financially in terms of companies that I bet on ended up putting me in the right rooms of people.
Sure.
Where now I got the respect of certain people where, okay, that guy's not full of shit. That's that dude from Chicago. He actually has money. He talks the talk and he walks the walk. You know what I mean? Maybe some of the people were respecting me because like, fuck, John put 200 grand into that deal. That deal fucking sucks. Well, he must be really rich.
Yeah. But at the same time, like some of the people you're talking about, you have partnerships with people like Kevin Garnett, people like Aaron Rodgers. I mean, like not just some business guy nobody's heard about, but like prominent names, right?
Exactly. And it ended up putting me in the right room of things that led to even bigger stuff. You know, I'm one of the early investors of Discord, and Discord's probably going to go public next year, hopefully. And I'm going to make a ton of money on that. There's not too many people that could call themselves early investors in Discord that are individual entities like me. I'm also a partner in the investment group that bought the Newport Beach Marriott Hotel.
We've now
reimagined it and reopened it as the Via. It's very popular in Newport Beach.
Wow, incredible, incredible. All right, W2, we got to get into this because it's a big part of what you talk about, and we're in the same spot. I exited corporate way later than you. You had your epiphany in your 20s. Mine was in my early 40s, but still, both exited W2, got out of it. There was something you talked about that I thought was so freaking perfect, well said, and it never occurred to me, and maybe you remember, maybe you don't remember saying this, but you were saying essentially like that in this from a sales perspective, like a B2B guy, the $80,000 a year guy, the low guy, is making too much, and the $300,000 a year high-end sales guy is not making enough. Can you explain that?
Yeah, you know what's funny about you saying that, man? That's some of my best shit right there. And guys like you that are smart understand it, but like social media doesn't play well with those kinds of reels, dude. Like literally, you know, before I talk about more about social media later, but I used to like only post shit like that, Jamie. And it was when I freaking stopped only doing that shit and yelling into my phone and talking about gambling. Then everything took off. When I would make points like that, it would do well for the 11,000 people that watched it, but it wouldn't go further than that. So there's very few people in a sales organization that aren't either being subsidized, or they're either the subsidizee or the subsidizer. Okay. And the people that are lower paid, they need to exist. Yeah, a great sales perform organization would say that you're going to weed out the people that are the low performers. But wherever that benchmark is, there's going to be low performers. You know, it's just going to be comparable to the rest of the organization. And maybe everybody's high performers, but there's going to be low performers within those with those high performers. And at the end of the day, the company is going to model their compensation plan to reflect subsidizers and subsidizees. Okay. So once a guy starts making the big bucks, the 300 grand, 400 grand plus, his hard dollar expenses associated with his existence don't necessarily change. You know what I mean? So maybe you have an account manager that's making X, and your office space, and you know, maybe your expense account goes up a little bit or whatever, but the disparity of what the company makes off of you versus what it was making on you, you know, gets larger and larger. You know what I mean? Like, look at an organization. Okay, you got a team of one account manager and say one client service rep, and you're making 80 grand. Okay, well, that same person that's making 500 grand, is he bringing in six times as much? Does he now have six client service reps and six account managers? Probably not. It's not going to proportionately grow like that. You know what I mean? And that's why he deserves the bigger bucks. That's why he deserves the bigger bucks. But the ultimate point I was trying to make with that reel is that if you're in that position where you are that high performer, figure it out, because you might be able to pivot and do this shit on your own because you're good at what you do, man. You're a rainmaker. The hardest job at any organization is bringing in the revenue. That's the hardest thing. Okay, everything else is learnable. You can learn every single piece, but to actually have the ability to go out there and hunt and bring in business, nothing's harder. You can't teach that shit, man. You could try, but you can't.
No, I agree. What was it? Mark Cuban? I think he has something. It was such a basic quote, but it was so true. It's just like sales. If you don't have sales, you don't have shit, right? Like, you have to have sales. That's period. Right. So good salespeople, good product, all of that stuff. But no, that makes total sense. Makes total sense. Let me go back for a second. There's a lot of different ways. I wrote down some things that I want to talk with you about, but that's just for context. You were a tight end at Notre Dame way back when.
Yep.
You said that not making it to the NFL was the best thing that happened to you. Why is that?
Yeah. Well, because if I would have played in the NFL, man, and I was good enough, I got hurt towards the end, decided it wasn't going to be in my best interest. I might end up in a wheelchair. This was a spinal injury. Like, I wouldn't have been like Peyton Manning or something. You know what I mean? Who knows? Maybe it was like, I could have, maybe I would have had a career like Gronkowski or something, but I doubt it. Most guys in my situation play in the NFL for two, three or four years, man.
Yeah.
And all the guys I played with at Notre Dame when I was 27 years old, all those NFL guys probably hadn't been playing in the league for a year and a half at that point, but they're still trying to play in the league. So now they're 27. They finally hang up their cleats and decide, okay, I got to go get a regular job. You know what I was doing when I was 27? Starting a company with a bunch of knowledge behind me from working in the industry for the 5 years previous, and later selling that company for a few dozen million dollars. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I had a head start. It would have backtracked me. And in addition to that, the other intangible is, I don't know, Jamie, I mean, are you going to go take some fucking office job if you've, you know, worked at frickin', or you've been in the starting tight end for the Cowboys the last 3 years, you know what I mean? And now you got to get some shitty job. And, you know, there's a guy named Chris Conte that played on the Chicago Bears.
Brady.
Good dude. I was just with him last weekend at this charity flag football thing. And, you know, he's getting into insurance and stuff, but he's saying, you know, it's a wake up call, dude. And especially if you're a guy like him, where he doesn't necessarily even look like a football player because of the safety. It's not like he's like 6'8" or something like that. You know what I mean?
I'll think of the wrong guy. Yeah.
You know, so people don't really know who he is just by looking at him, but he had a great career in the NFL, but now he's out there just sitting at a desk like everybody else, man. You know, if you're able to make tens of millions, yeah, forget everything I just said, but most aren't, and I highly doubt I would have.
Were you, I'm just curious, were you a prospect? Were you like ranked? Would you have been drafted?
Yeah, I would have been. I would have probably been, the best projection for me was fourth round, but more likely fifth or sixth round. It would have depended how I did in pro timing days, which I didn't even bother to do. I got invited to play in it's called the Blue Gray All-Star Game.
Oh yeah.
That was supposed to be my big coming out party to see how it goes, and ended up failing the physical for that, where they found the injury or they decided I can't really play anymore.
So, yeah, spinal injury, right? It's a spinal cord injury of some sort?
Yeah, man. It's freaking dodged a bullet, dude. The whole damn half of my senior year, bro, I'm hitting people, and every time I hit them, when you hit my shoulder, I'd feel it down in my ankles. Like, I'd feel a twitch in my ankle. And there's something called stingers that people in football get, where your arm gets numb when you hit people, and you kind of just get used to that. Well, I was getting them in my legs, and I didn't know that wasn't normal. It's never really talked about it either. Mm-hmm. And during the physical for the Blue-Gray game, because it started getting really bad at the end of the year, to the point where if you like just tapped my ear, I'd feel it in like the ball of my ankle. It was like weird. So I get invited to this Blue-Gray game. They're doing the damn physical. Doctor's asking me questions. Anything else bothering you? I go, you know, I've had this weird thing happen, and just kind of mentioned it. He goes, we should probably get that looked at. Doesn't x-ray. Nothing comes up with the x-ray. And he says, you know, I'm still not comfortable with this. Let's get you an MRI. And it was very clear on the MRI, I had a contusion to my spinal cord, where the prognosis was it's weakened already. And when it looks like this, it's just one hit away from eventually snapping and putting you in the wheelchair the rest of your life. So, you know, you can look at things a lot of different ways, man. And had I not got invited to that Blue-Gray game, I probably never would have gotten that physical, and you know, who knows, and maybe I get invited to an NFL camp, and you know, by that point I forgot that I even had this injury and don't even mention it to them. I'm too worried about making the Philadelphia Eagles, and in a preseason game John Sirianni ends up paralyzed. You know what I mean? And I can tell you right now, Jamie, it would have been a tragedy at the time if it happened, but here we are, you know, 25 years later, nobody would still be talking about it, I'll tell you that much. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and that's true.
And I'd still be sitting there in a wheelchair. So, you know, there's blessings in disguise, I guess you could say, my friend.
No doubt. No doubt. Did you play for Holtz? Was he the coach back then?
Yeah, I played for Lou Holtz his last 2 years. Then he got, I'm using air quotes for you guys on audio. Then he resigned. Yeah, he resigned. And he got fired. And I got in a little trouble. That was my sophomore year. And I got in a little bit of trouble off campus. Not a little bit, a lot of it. And I got suspended for a semester from school because I got into a fight. And then I decided that instead of coming back to Notre Dame after that suspension, I was going to transfer. I was a starting tight end at Notre Dame at the time, so like I could have transferred anywhere. And what I got in trouble for was not like a bad thing. Like it wasn't like shoplifting or like sexual assault or something. And me and another player got in a freaking fight with each other, morons. And the kid's dad told the school. Football team didn't even punish us, and the kid's dad told the damn school because he was mad that I beat up his son. Which I'm laughing about it, but it's kind of, I mean, it is kind of funny. But anyway, I decided to transfer to Northwestern. Northwestern was very good at football at the time. They had just went to the Big Ten Championship, Rose Bowl, and then the Citrus Bowl back-to-back. Northwestern's close to where I'm from in Schaumburg, Illinois. And, you know, went there and finished the next 3 years there. And, you know, it was fun.
I'm curious, and this might be a reach, but the fight that you had, was it in defense of somebody else on your side? Or was it just something where you two got fueled up? And
there was a Chicago Tribune article that gets into the details of it that talks about it. Maybe that's what you came across or other people.
No, I have another reason for asking that question, but I'll explain it in a second. But go ahead.
Well, the way the Tribune article reads is, you know, we're buddies. We're out all night. It's the truth. And it was 4 a.m. I said something to him. He said something to me. My mom's in a wheelchair. She had MS. He said something about her.
Yeah, there you go.
Cracked him in the nose and broke his nose. That's where it comes from. Here's the damn thing, dude. You think you're helping your damn kid out by being a big mouth parent, and he didn't help his kid out at all, man. That kid was a linebacker on the team. I broke his freaking nose. Everyone knew he was kind of a freaking asshole, okay? And, like, I end up getting kicked out of school for it. Notre Dame's football team is worse the next fall because they don't have me. I would have helped the team. I was supposed to be the starting tight end. Well, and then the kid ends up fucking quitting the team because he's getting fucking picked on over this damn thing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's like, dude, so the kid's dad goes out of his way. I'll never forget it, man. I never even talk about this shit. My dad drove to South Bend as soon as he found out it happened. Okay, he wants to get ahead of this. Hey, this wasn't good. My dad was going to kill me for doing it, by the way. As soon as I said broken nose, he was like, are you nuts? And the problem, Jamie, was that any other Division I football program in the country probably wouldn't have been in any trouble. Notre Dame's football program wasn't even in any trouble. Problem was, Notre Dame's a Catholic institution, and once the school finds out about it at the administration of their school, well, they got to follow their own damn rules. So we had a student disciplinary hearing, all this shit. Well, right there in black and white, if you cause physical harm to another student and break a bone in their body, it is either you're either suspended for a semester or you're expelled. They suspended me, and everybody thought, okay, just serve your suspension, come back to damn school, because back then when you transferred, you had to sit out a year anyway. So I was screwed for that following. I wasn't playing that following fall anyway, unless I went to like a junior college, which I wasn't going to do. So, you know, that's kind of how that went down. I could tell you this though, man, that sitting out that damn year set me back, bro, for not, like, I was prime, dude. I was running a 4.7. I was about 275.
Damn.
I freaking squatted 615. I was benching about 410. Beast, 340 power clean. And I was a good-ass tight end, dude. If I had the shit to do over again, well, first of all, I wouldn't have punched him if I had to do anything over again. You know what I mean? You know, that's probably a good idea there, but I would not be in that situation. And also, me and the guy were good friends, too. So it kind of ruined our friendship. But bigger than that, though, outside of that, I could have just went to the NFL, dude. When I look back now, I had barely played at Notre Dame as a backup tight end at that point, but this was my coming out party to be the starter. I was good enough to play in the NFL at that point, because I looked at myself 2 years later, I had injuries caught up to me, sitting out of your bad habits caught up to me, and all this other shit. And gosh, man, I go to Northwestern, where the team was good, but we ended up sucking the years I was there. You know, they're good before that. Then, you know, there's no one out there talking about, like, hey, remember that freaking 4-7 Northwestern team in 1998 that Sarasani was on? Like, no one's talking about that. You know what I mean? So it's like, I will say I have a lot of friends from Northwestern, though, and Notre Dame. But, you know, another funny thing is when I tell people I played football at Northwestern, they look at me like, wow, you must be smart. And I tell people when I tell people I played football at Notre Dame, they're like, wow, you must be good at football. Jamie, which would you rather be when you're in your 40s, smart or good at football, right?
That's funny. That's really funny. Well, the reason I asked about that, like, so, all right, look, you have this brand, which we're going to get into maybe a question or two from now. That's like really big, really brash. I took a page from your book recently, and I had this fucking person commenting that I just had to call him out. I just had to call him out, and I did this post on it, and it was awesome. It felt so good. So I see why you do it. But big brash. But at the same time, I followed you for a while, and you've got this, like, oh, what do I say? Like, you've got this, like, defense of the little guy thing to you. So you've got a friend, I don't know his name, I think that's Blind, goes all the way back to high school. Yeah. Like, you like, I remember you carrying this guy in a video you shared into the gym. And then later on, you still show up and meet this guy. He's still a friend of yours. So, like, you're there for the little guy. Your mom, your dad, we'll talk about that here in a moment. Your mom had MS toward the end of her life. Ends up probably what cost her life. So, like, your mom being defensive. So when you said, I punched the guy, I'm thinking, oh, and then the other one, I don't know where this is. And we can edit this if you need to, but I know, I think it's been published that you are an investor in another guest I've had on here in Billy McFarland's Fire Festival. Billy McFarland, for many people, will be a little guy, right? He went to jail for fraud, everything else. And you're investing in him. Like, you see something in this kid, like everyone else is shitting on him. And you're the one saying, you know what? I'm willing to be behind you. I believe in you or whatever. So the spirit I feel like I get from you is that you are less, it's less about coming at you. It's more about what, you know, who's coming at people that you feel need your defense. Is that a fair assessment?
That's a fair assessment. I wouldn't call myself an investor in Fyre Festival. We could talk more about that, but sure. Your assessment and your overall point is definitely spot on.
Tell me about Fyre Festival. What is that? What are you doing with it?
So I'm part of the, if it happened, or not if, when it happens, right, Billy, when it happens, part of the team that's going to make sure it goes the right way. Billy was on my podcast a while ago, or actually shortly after he got out of jail. And, you know, as a venture capitalist myself, I'm listening to him and his story. And, you know, he made some mistakes, but I got to tell you, it becomes a blurred line when you deal with these founders that are out there raising money for their companies. You know,
100%.
Optimism. Yeah. Becomes very blurred with lying, you know, and Billy obviously took it too far, but some of the principles that he went to jail over, I could look at some of these early stage founders that I've done business with, and if I had phone calls recorded of them, they're right there against that freaking line with Billy.
No shit, you know what I mean? Yeah. Right?
Well, because people are so damn optimistic, man, and they're not, and Billy wasn't taking the money and going buying Lamborghinis or something with
it. He was putting the festival on. It was a fucking train wreck, but he actually put the festival on.
Exactly. He was dumping that money into trying to make it work still. You know what I mean? And I've had situations where it's like founders are raising this convertible. No, dude, the ship's already fucking sinking. And as I look back retrospectively, it's like, dude, that 50 grand you took from him is just like throwing it down the toilet while the water's already freaking flushing, dude. You know what I mean? And I don't know what people think, that they think that magically something's going to be saved. But I'd put Billy in that category. And I'd also put Billy in the category of he was only 24 years old when this whole thing started. And I will also say that he did go to jail for it and did serve his time for it. So with that all being said, you know, what kind of society are we in, right? I'm a proponent of people coming out of prison and trying to do positive things. Billy owes people a lot of freaking money, and he has to give 15% of everything he makes the rest of his life to pay that back, and going to be paying back, you know, tens of millions of dollars by, you know, a regular job. So there's a lot of reasons that Fyre Festival 2, if it works or when it works, would be a very positive thing for a lot of reasons. You know, so that's kind of how I was looking at the thing, Jamie. And me and Billy, really, this was when I was just getting going in social media. Things were starting to move the right direction. Billy had a lot of media, really more mainstream media going on around him, and kind of just made a quid pro quo kind of deal. Hey, man, I'm going to help you with this stuff. You need to get some, you know, some maybe business person credibility on your side of the table with some of these phone calls you're having. I started participating on calls with certain people. We have a big festival organizer that I was very, very relevant in getting that underway, that we're about to announce that a signing with, which is going to be big news, you know. And then he, on the other hand, was able to, you know, run Entertainment Tonight. We're on freaking News Nation. We're on all these shows. And I wasn't very big on social media at that time, man. So it was truly kind of a quid pro quo thing. We were helping each other out. And there's very little downside. You know what I mean? There was very little downside. If it doesn't work, I don't really lose anything. And, you know, he won't be happy if the Fyre doesn't work. But if he wasn't able to get me stuff, you know, it's the relationship itself specifically did not have much downside. I think I have enough bullets in the gun where people are going to look past my association with Billy as a negative thing, even if they hate that association. Sure. I will get DMs from people here and there. And Jamie, you've been following me for a while. You probably saw that a year ago. I was probably posting about me and Billy a little bit,
yep,
you know, a lot more than I kind of do currently, because the nature of the relationship was kind of to boost each other up from a media standpoint. And I don't really necessarily need that from him anymore. So for me, it's more about the focus on, hey, if we get the right people involved on Fyre Festival 2, let's make this fucking thing work. Because I'm going to tell you right now, anyone that's actually met with Billy, never heard anyone refer to him as a dumb guy. I don't think anyone walks away from that conversation being like, what a fucking idiot. I mean, he is a smart dude, maybe a little bit on the spectrum, even the way he goes about things. And, you know, I mean that in a positive way. You had him on your podcast too, didn't you, Jamie?
I did. Yeah. And it's funny you say that, like the entrepreneur, I had that takeaway, man. I don't know how to, I'll try to articulate this without getting too long winded, but so when you're in a bubble, if you didn't know who was who, right? And you were just to talk about two different people, Billy being one of them, we don't know that. And the other one being like, I don't know, Elon or whatever, right? Yep. Some of the tenets that we admire in the stories of these types of people exist in both. In other words, Billy was highly optimistic. He stretched the truth. And there were some things that I called him on like some of the stuff in his pitch deck or whatever, but he stretched through and he got what he got. He deserved what he did, and he did his time. But every entrepreneur that that I've ever met, I don't know of one, maybe you do, does the job of saying, I am going to build this parachute on the way down. Every entrepreneur jumps and builds the parachute on the way down. Billy's problem was he jumped with a lead weight strap to his chest and didn't have any cloth on him to build the parachute, right? But like the tenets of what he was trying to do was, no, we can catch up to this. We're going to rally. We're going to get there. We're going to build it. And it got to a point, if you watch his story, in my opinion, where it's like, dude, right here is where you should have called it. And he even admits that, like, call it here, but he let it go here. And then you're just, like you said, you're beyond a tipping point. But the optimism, the embellishing maybe a little bit of what's going to happen. Like every entrepreneur does that. Every entrepreneur. And then there's a point where some of these entrepreneurs go too far with it. And then there's the point where Billy went, which is like too far. But I don't know if I'm explaining that. I'm not in defense. I'm not defending the fact that people were defrauded or people lost because of Billy's actions. Not at all. But the core of the behavior of like optimistic driven forward, he didn't, like you said, he didn't take the money and run. It wasn't a Ponzi scheme. He didn't, I guess it was a bit of a Ponzi scheme, but it wasn't a misappropriation of funds. It was all in on a shitty festival, essentially, what it boiled down to. He under-delivered.
He couldn't execute the vision, and everybody's in love with the vision. And, if you watch the documentary, it really spells it out. And I got a picture of Pablo Escobar behind me. The original island they were supposed to be on pulled the rug out on him because he went and marketed it as Pablo Escobar used to freaking sell cocaine here. And because it was in the movie Blow and all this shit. Yeah. What the fuck are you? Why would you say that? Anybody that knows anything about the Bahamas would know that Bahamians aren't going to like that kind of a reference, dude. If you spend any time in the Bahamas, it's, they don't want to be thought of as
it's like Germany for the Nazis. Oh, this is all Nazi stuff. They don't want to be known for that shit today, right?
Man, and go try to buy real estate there. They're gonna, dude. I was gonna buy real estate there, bro. They made me get a freaking letter from my local police chief. All this shit to show that I was like legitimately behind the money I'm paying for this stuff. Yeah, man. So I don't know. I think your characterization is pretty accurate, though, man. And I hope it works out. I think, like I said, man, the vision was there. It was the execution lacked. And I will say this about Fyre. Here's a soundbite for you too. Fyre Festival 2. Okay. Billy McFarland from Fyre Festival 1 doesn't owe money to people that went there and bought cabanas and got stuck. Most of those people got refunded through their credit card, chargebacks. He owes money to people like me, rich motherfuckers that put in like $100,000 or $200,000 or $600,000. That's who he owes the money to. So if he has a chance to pay those people back, I'm going to tell you right now, Jamie, if 12 years from now, somebody came to me on one of my shitty investments and say, hey, remember that fucking $300,000 you gave us in 2020? Here, we got the chance to pay you back now. I'm going to welcome that phone call, bro. I'm going to welcome that phone call. You know what I mean? True. And there's no way he's going to pay any of these people back without Fyre Festival 2, period.
Makes sense. Makes perfect sense. All right, let's flash forward a little bit. We're getting toward the top of the hour. I want to make sure we land the plane to talk about social. Okay. Your mom passes 2014, suddenly. You said your dad didn't bury the ashes right away. It took him a while to do that. Can you get into the why? What was your dad going through in that time?
It was so it was such an interesting time, man. So me and my brother and my mom and my dad were very tight, the four of us. And my mom suddenly passes away. She had MS, but she wasn't about to die or anything like that. And she had kind of had MS for a while. She got it when she was like 40. So it was just kind of a way of life, but it has complications that impact other pieces of your body. And, ultimately we think that's probably why she ended up dying, but she ended up having a heart attack when she was 64. And, we do this big to-do with a cemetery. We got the plot and all this stuff. And, talk about something eerie. It's like that tombstone. Other people could probably relate to this. You have that tombstone and, people's names are on it that are alive. My dad's name's on the damn thing. They're just waiting to put the dates under there because it'll be buried next to my mom, right? So it's always kind of be eerie to me, but he didn't want to bury the ashes, man. So we had this whole plot and everything, but we didn't bury the ashes. 4 years later, out of the clear blue sky, he decides, it's time. I think it's time we bury mom's ashes. Now, a couple weeks before that, he starts giving like heirlooms to my kids, my brother's kids. After 4 years, here's grandma's necklace, like stuff like that. And kind of strange, out of nowhere, he's talking about this. So we go to the cemetery, we bury the ashes finally. Five or 6 days later, my dad drops dead and dies. So, and he was healthy. So we think
heart attack.
Truly, another heart attack. So we think it's a broken heart, me and my brother always kidding. Did he know he was about to die and didn't tell us? And they're like, no, this is a heart attack that came out of nowhere. You couldn't have predicted it. It was a black widow. He was actually at the hospital. He had a chest pains. He goes to the hospital. The EKG is fine. They're going to keep you in. We're going to keep you in here overnight, man, for observations. They tell him. He calls me up. He goes, I'm at the hospital. It's fine. Don't worry about it. has a heart attack and dies in the freaking hospital, Jamie.
And you were in Idaho?
I was in Sioux City, or no, yeah, I was in Sioux City, Iowa.
Iowa.
And actually had I misspoke to another podcast. I said a wedding, and I started thinking about it more. I was actually at the funeral of one of my friend Ray's dad died, and I was at his funeral in Sioux City, Iowa. I fly back. My dad dies that freaking night.
So you didn't get to say goodbye to either of your parents.
No.
Does that kind of loss mess with somebody? Like, does it make it harder for you to have deep, meaningful relationships today because of the fact that, man, I could lose people without being able to say goodbye to them?
You know, I never looked at it that way. I definitely wish I was able to have a couple more days with each of them, because I'm blessed from the standpoint that I never had to see either of them really suffer. My mom suffered with MS, but that's a different kind of thing. She wasn't dying.
Yep.
You know, I know a lot of other people our age, Jamie, that... You know, they watch their parents get dementia, then you move to hospice, and you know, that whole path is not pleasant. So I sometimes like to think that, you know, the universe was looking out for my parents, that especially my mom. Hey, even though everything was fine, these next 10 years weren't going to be good for her, you know, so let's kind of die here while we're on top. And I like to think about it that way, and who knows?
Yeah, I have both my parents still. So this is a topic. They're older, they're in their 70s, and I, you know, you can see that they're degrading a bit, right? Like, you know, their health is starting to degrade. So I haven't gone through this experience yet. So hearing that you had to go through it twice, two times unexpected, and the inability to sort of, I don't know, it's made me FaceTime my parents more, right? You know, like, so.
Nice. That's nice, man. Yeah. Yeah. You know, I know my parents both knew I loved them and stuff, so I don't really regret that part of it, but it's like, oh, no. God, if we could have one more day, like, talk about like family. Hey, what do you want me to tell the great grandkids about you guys? What do you want to be remembered for? You know, shit like that.
Yeah. No, I get it. All right. Let's get a little less heavy. Let's go into social media. So you mentioned that you were starting on social. Like, what's the incentive for you at this point? Like, you've made good money. I know you've got the 2000% Race podcast. You've got a community that you built, and you're doing some really cool stuff there. Yeah. But what is the incentive? What's the desire? What's the motivation for you with your social media strategy right now?
Well, I got to tell you right now, man. So right now with my whole brand, 2000% Race, everything I'm doing on social media, I've really kind of made the decision for the short term, at least, that I don't even want to try to make money, because if I make a couple grand here or lose a couple grand there, like, it's not really going to move the needle for me. So I'd rather just make sure everything's genuine, everything's authentic. Yeah. You know, I have these events in person. They're always people are very well priced. And they're like, dude, how are you doing all this shit? It's like $300. Yeah, well, no shit. I'm not making any fucking money on it. That's how. You know what I mean? Yeah, probably losing money. Ding, ding, ding. No shit. Now, luckily, I got people around me that believe in the movement and are people that kind of assist me that are working really not for very much money, because they want to be part of this. There are people with full-time jobs, or other people in, you know, younger people that maybe are in college that, hey, they're donating their time because they like everything that we're doing here. And, you know, it's funny, man. It's the capital that exists with social media, and you know, for a lack of a better word, almost like clout. I gotta tell you, man, I'm seeing it more and more now, Jamie, these past probably 6 months, where people are just want to be a part of things, man. They fucking think this is cool, dude. And it's true even for celebrities, bro. I'm making friends with celebrities now that think I'm just as cool because of they see my shit on social. Dude, you're fucking hilarious, dude. We send this around and they're naming like big name people. I'm like, holy shit. Well, tell him to fucking follow me. I think he already does. I go, holy shit, he does fucking follow me. That's pretty cool. You know, like stuff like that, man. You know, so it's a heck of a lot of fun, man. I think, you know, if I could do something in media, bro, that would be my end game, buddy.
What do you mean in media? What does that mean?
Like something where, you know, a podcast that's picked up by like Barstool or Spotify, something big like that, or have my own TV show, something of that nature, I think would be where I'd have the most fun. I think an easier path for me, Jamie, would be to monetize the entrepreneurial journey that I'm on and do things more along the lines of, like, you know, there's people that sell courses or have seminars and things of that nature. I look at that stuff and I know I could bring value there. I don't like the nature of how you have to go about it to get people into your like sales funnel to do that, though. There's something that just
bothers you. Yeah.
Yeah. It just feels a little slimy to me. Even, well, why would you feel slimy? You know, you're bringing value. I go, dude, I don't want to be pitching people like that. You know what I mean? So, you know, maybe I keep having these events and I get bigger companies to sponsor it. Like, you know, maybe Bank of America has a small business unit and they want to, you know, they want to sponsor the 2000% Raise events because we have a bunch of entrepreneurs there. You know, maybe I'll make money on that side of it. Who knows? But as it is right now, it's really just about building the brand.
What's core to your strategy right now? So like what I've watched is you've kind of gone from, you said it like, you know, here's the financial advice. I know you do shit on, which is true, rent versus buy, you know, whether you should pay off your house, all of that stuff, just kind of general financial advice. But then, like I said, you'll go through and do blackjack. You'll be partying in Vegas and put stuff out. And then like the, I love personally blowing up some of the haters, the ones that like you put up the video, like this is so-and-so. I think they're hilarious. So is it just like whatever feels good, raw, go, or is there something else? There's something else to the strategy. I'm asking honestly for me personally.
Well, it is funny. As the following gets bigger and bigger and more loyal, you start to get away with more shit. You know what I mean? I got one right now. You might notice here. I'm clean shaved. I'm not usually. I made a reel this morning. I'm debating if I'm going to post it or not. But I was trying to straighten up my goatee and I went too far and it all ended up coming off lately because I just was the point of no return. Oh, fuck, I'm taking it all off. So for the first time in a year. So a year ago, I would not bother posting that. But now I'm like, okay, because now people are loyal followers. They're going to appreciate like day in the life kind of stuff like that. They're going to crack up. I'm probably not going to get new followers off of a reel like that. But It makes you look human. It makes you look like, all right, this guy will fucking post anything. He don't give a fuck. You know what I mean? Whereas before, it's like, who the fuck are you? No one wants to hear your bullshit, bro.
Where's the most reach coming from? Where do you get the most followers? When do you notice a pop? What kind of content?
Casinos, blackjack.
Like, really?
For sure. Yeah.
So resolve this for me then real quick. So you got blackjack. So I'm assuming people are there like, oh, this is interesting. He's talking about like, you know, the right strategy. I know you talk about like gen pop versus, you know, going to the high roller suite and all that stuff. But those folks follow you through the rest, quitting the job and so on and so forth. So like, I guess everybody kind of globally, most people, 80%, whatever, don't want to do their job. So is there like a reliance on like, well, people who want to quit their job, most people also like playing blackjack. So I hook them with blackjack. I nurture them with W2.
So I'll get a DM probably twice a week that will sing the tune of, hey, bro, started following you because of your blackjack stuff, but I just want to let you know you're super motivating and I'm trying to grow my side hustle to quit my job one day. Like I'm paraphrasing, but I'll get a message like that at least twice a week, literally, at least probably fucking 10 times a day. I'll get something with someone say, hey, man, you inspired me, literally on average 10 times a day. You know, this is awesome. Keep doing what you're doing. I think there's a relatable thing about me. Because I talk about being from Schaumburg, and it's not a ghetto, it's not a bad neighborhood, it's but very middle class. Everybody knows somebody from a place like Schaumburg, or most people are from a place like Schaumburg. So I think people really appreciate that aspect and find me relatable from that standpoint. And this was never really by design, by the way. It wasn't like, okay, well, I got to put relatable content so it gets more clicks.
You're just sharing your life. You're sharing your journey.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. So I try to tell people that, like, that's my, like, the thing that pivoted for me, because I've been, you know, creating content for years. When I had my job, it was like the way out. I was the real estate guy for a while. Like, here's a tip on call segregation. It's just fucking cringy. I hated it because I'm trying to think of shit to talk about.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, I just started like documenting what I'm doing. Like, kind of like, you know, I'm at the casino. Here's something I learned, blah, 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 blah. And that's where it really took off. And it's funny, like, comedy and like green screen news articles, those get me reach. People come in, and then what they stay for. I literally just did a day in the life post today, day in the life. What are you describing? Right. Just me going to my dermatologist. What's it like going to a doctor in a third world country is the thought of it, or in a developing nation. And it was, I showed my neighborhood, this is what I'm doing, blah, 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 blah. Right. So that's what grows the nurture part of it. Go ahead. You want to say something?
Well, so I like what you do, Jamie, a lot. Actually, I think I've DM'd you a few times even about it. I really like what you're doing, but as far as you growing, I don't know if you ever will because it's so niche. No one's fucking... Yep. Has that goal to move to Dominican Republic one day, but you're educating us on there, and all people like me that have vacationed there, I'm interested in what the fuck you have to say. And then I'll listen and say, oh, okay. You know what I mean? It's going to be a big lift to actually convince people to move there. You know what I mean? So I don't know if your stuff's ever going to go like super viral. Maybe it will, but
it's got to elevate. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I think, dude, honestly, so mine was broader than that, right? I was talking about leaving corporate America to be an entrepreneur and why corporate America might screw you over. Okay. That was pretty broad, a lot broader than what you're talking about. But when it really took off is when I broadened it to include the gambling and shit. And then I was fortunate because celebrities started paying attention to my shit. So every once in a while, you know, I was just with Aaron Rodgers, put a picture of me and Aaron Rodgers up there. I'm like, okay, it just legitimizes everything more for people. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I do. No, it's a great point. Like on my stuff, I see that we're top of the hour. We got to go here in a second. But on my stuff, you're right. Like right now, the thing that's happening is people are like, I'd never consider. I wanted to buy a vacation home. Never considered. Yeah. But now I am Dominican Republic and I've got a realtor I refer people to and I get a cut of his commission. There's no licensing rule down here. So somebody just bought a $500,000 condo in Capcana and I'll get 25% of this realtor's commission for that just by making the connection. Oh, so nice. I make a lot of those connections daily. Right. But I want more global. Like this podcast is tailored toward entrepreneurs more globally, tribe of millionaires, right? All of that. So I have a guy I work with, a branding coach, and he's the one working. He's like, stay niche for a minute. Stay niche. Mm. We're going to elevate it. We'll collab with other people that are like living abroad or quit their job, and then we'll continue to elevate it. So it's like you said, you were broad, and then I kind of look at it like you niche down one more level and said, quit your job, and then, hey, there's the gambling side. And that's where the oil sprouted, and now you're able to bring them back up to where you are. And that's where I feel like I was like, quit your job, and it was like, well, move here. That was like the niche dig down where the oil sprouted. Now I got to build it back up. So
Well, and also you got charisma too, dude. Like, so there's a lot of shit, and you're just gonna get better and better at it too when you go, bro. I look at some of my stuff from like 2 years ago, and I wish I didn't. You know what I mean? I wouldn't post that now probably. But you know, there is something about the style, and then I think you just kind of see what plays, and you kind of lean into it a little bit while still being authentic. You know what I mean? And
you're fat, like you're quick. Your cadence, like your mind to mouth is fast, man. Like it's unedited. You're able to go through a whole thing. I love how you're bringing the waterfall. Like to your point, that charisma is the intangible you can't teach. That's like size in basketball. You can't teach height or you can't teach speed, right?
Yeah. I think. That's exactly right, dude. You nailed it. Well, dude, guys, can I say one thing about Punta Cana though?
Yeah, please.
So I'm going from the airport to my resort there and I'll never forget it. I mean, like,
Which resort real quick? Sorry.
You know, it was an all inclusive. Yeah. This is probably like 2013-ish, and I'll never forget like looking to the right of the taxi or I was in one of those like passenger vans where they're bringing us from the hotel and there was like a guy on I want to say it was like a motorcycle, but there was
probably a dirt bike.
Yeah, but there was like five people on it somehow driving it. There's somebody on the fucking handlebars. Then there was another person smaller in between him and the person on the handlebars, and then there were two people on the fucking back, and I'm like, what the fuck.
I saw a moped recently, and this isn't Punta Cana as much anymore because Punta Cana has grown and has become very westernized. But like the next city over where my wife is originally from, Higüey, it's very like Dominican, right? So I saw a moped, like one of those, you know, like where you would hold it and you'd step on the floor of it. Yeah. It was dad, mom, little kid in between, little kid standing up and dog on the platform.
So this is normal. This is normal. Well, normal. And also I learned a lot on that visit. I always like to take little gems of information that I think are interesting and find ways to include it in like dinner conversations. Conversation in the future or whatever. And one of the takeaways I had was I didn't realize the disdain that Dominicans and the Haitians have for each other, or that the Dominicans have for the Haitians, at least almost to the degree that they don't want to be associated with them at all. And which is amazing, because when you look at the map, it's like, how do you even decipher the two? It's like, how do you know if you're from Illinois or Indiana? You know what I mean?
It's a lot of race to that. So like Dominicans are lighter skin, Haitians are darker skin. There's some of that. And then on top of it, like Dominicans are born almost, and this is not my word, somebody here told me, like, we're almost born with like an innate distrust, or we're taught very young not to trust Haiti. There was, you know, Haiti ruled the island at one point. Dominican fought for its independence, so it's like generational. But right now, all the shit that's happening, like, it's there's no animosity. There's a lot of animosity. No
level. What stops it from spilling over to your side of the island?
So you talk about border, right? Border protection in the U.S., all the debate on like, oh, is it humanitarian? Like here, they don't give a fuck. Like they are at the border heavy, and they've literally like arrested women, Haitian women in bed giving birth, like tied them to the bed so they could deport them right after. Like it's bullshit, no bones about it. They're extremely aggressive at the border.
Well, so in Evanston, Illinois, which is where Northwestern University is, but Evanston High School, it's a suburb, but it's a pretty big city in itself. Anyway, they have a very big Haitian population, and I won't say one of the people that works there kind of indicated to me is like, these Haitian kids, some of them moved here like in eighth grade, and you know, their fucking background's a little different. You think south side of Chicago is rough? Those kids are coming with different stories.
Imagine, man. Like it's, you win and lose the birth lottery, right? Like you're born in that country. It's always been chaos. It's even worse now, but there's the prime minister stepped down, sought asylum in DR, and the president here was like, nope, you can't come here, right? Like there's just
he said, beat it.
They draw that line and it's done. So it's a very aggressive border protection policy that the DR has.
And then Haiti's army is not strong enough. They're civil warring, right?
Yeah, they have a police force. They killed a gang leader recently, I guess. Okay. But yeah,
But Dominican military to keep them Dominican Republic to keep them out of it. The Dominican Republic's military is a lot stronger than Haiti's.
Very, yeah. Dominican Republic's DR just got upgraded to in Fitch's and Moody's credit rating to like one step below where the U.S. is right now. So DR has been like developing and growing. It's sort of a gem in the Caribbean or in South America. Haiti is, yeah. So there's a military. And air forces, all of that DR has. It's very strong, I guess. Yeah. And Haiti just has, you know, chaos.
When was the hurricane? So when Port-au-Prince got wiped out with a hurricane, I was there right before that. Do you remember what year that was?
The earthquake or the hurricane?
Well, whatever wiped out Port-au-Prince, like in the last...
It was earthquake first. That was okay. The Clinton Foundation came in, brought a bunch of money and did nothing with the city. Then there was a hurricane after, yeah. Earthquake was probably 10, 15 years ago at this point.
I think I was there right before that because Port-au-Prince in Haiti was still thought of as a sought-after place when I was there.
Yeah, you could go there. It's a bustling city. It's, you know, all of that. But yeah, now it's chaos. Gotcha. Port-au-Prince is actually where it all is. Like if you lived in the countryside of Haiti, you don't really see, from what I'm told, you don't really see what you're hearing on the news. It's more like Port-au-Prince and right around it.
Got
crazy.
It. Got it.
Crazy. Yeah. It's insane. But awesome, anyway.
Man. Well, hey, man. John, congrats on all your success, buddy. I've been watching you grow on social media too. It's cool to, I don't even remember how we came to know each other. I think we just started following.
I think I was following you when you were doing W2 stuff. And then I started to rip off your stuff and do similar shit. It was like, this is really good. I was going to do what he says. Success leaves clues. Yeah, I think you followed back and, you know, we just kind of connected there. Billy did after I was on the, sometimes I ask guests like, hey, if there's anyone else you think would be a great guest. And he referred me right to you. So I think that was the first like crossover from social media to like email or whatever. So.
Yeah. But it was funny though. Because that was part of me. Remember I said me and Billy kind of had our quid pro quo deal. He was supposed to be doing media opportunities. And he introduced me to you. We're like, we already know each other, Billy. This one doesn't count. This one doesn't count, Billy.
Check it out. Yeah, cross that one out. So I appreciate you, man. Any is there a website anywhere? Just go to Instagram. Where should people follow you, learn more about you?
So 2000%raise.com, 2000, then the word percent, the word raise.com, and then at John Sarasani on YouTube, or excuse me, Instagram and TikTok, and then John Sarasani TV on YouTube. I have a TV show coming out called The Partner, where it's kind of a Shark Tank meets The Prophet meets The Apprentice kind of thing, which I think people will like a lot.
Oh, I'll watch that. That's cool, man. I appreciate you doing this, brother.
All right, bro. Thanks, man.